You're on a GLP-1, but now you're wondering, how do I manage my side effects? What do I eat to stay strong? Because reaching your weight loss goals can take more than meds. That's where Weight Watchers Med Plus comes in. Get access to trusted experts, food plans that work with your body, and habit coaching to keep you on track. Plus access to GLP-1 medication. Get started at WeightWatchers.com. All medical services are provided through our affiliated medical group, Weight Watchers Clinic. Medications require eligibility and prescription. Individual results may vary. See site for more details.
Before we get started with this episode, I want to share something that I think could be a game changer for your classroom. Now, as a former special education teacher, one of the things I struggled with the most was creating activities, resources, and curriculum for my classroom. I did not realize that that was part of my job. I have spent the last 10 years developing the Autism Helper curriculum based on what was missing from my former classroom. And now we finally have a way for school districts to purchase this curriculum directly for their teachers. The Autism Helper Curriculum Access is an annual subscription that provides access to all levels and subjects of our curriculum. This curriculum is rooted in evidence-based practices, it's aligned to the standards, and we just completed our pilot case study showing the overall effectiveness. To learn more about how your district can get curriculum access, head over to theautismhelper.com and click Curriculum Access.
Hi, I'm Sasha Long, special ed teacher and board-certified behavior analyst. Welcome to the Autism Helper podcast. I'm here to explore different strategies to improve the lives of individuals with autism.
I'm really excited to share today's interview with you. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Destiny Huff. She is a non-attorney special education advocate, a mental health therapist, and was late diagnosed autistic. She has such a great perspective to share, and I love the framework that she is able to put on different concepts and components of the IEP because of the really unique perspective that she shares. She is also the parent of neurodivergent children. We have a great conversation. I honestly could have talked to her for about double the time, about IEPs, about mental health, about advocacy, about the role of educators in all of this. There is so much great information here. If you want to learn more from her, you can head over to her website, destinyhuffconsulting.com. I'll link that in the show notes. I love following her on Instagram. She is Dr. Destiny Huff on Instagram as well. I can't wait for you to hear everything she has to share. Welcome back to the Autism Helper podcast. I am so excited to be here with Dr. Destiny Huff to talk about IEPs and advocacy and everything under that umbrella. Dr. Huff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I'd love for you to share a little bit about your professional background and how this informs the way that you look at IEPs.
Yeah, so I am late diagnosed autistic and ADHD. I got my diagnosis after my oldest son entered the public school system undiagnosed in Louisiana, because we are a military family. And so my background before that was mental health. So I'm a mental health therapist. I'm a certified trauma therapist for children and adolescents. And then upon navigating, you know, really ableism, and some racism in Louisiana, we finally got my son the support he needed. And the advocate that supported us at the time was on the base, the Army base. And she was like, you could be an advocate. And so I was like, okay. And I already knew I was going to have to support my son when we moved. And my youngest son is ADHD with a speech delay. And so that's what led to me becoming an advocate. And so mental health therapy and trauma, that all shapes how I support my learners, as well as being a parent of neurodivergent learners, as well as being autistic and ADHD myself.
You bring such a valuable expertise. I feel like we don't normally hear, I don't meet that many advocates that have that background, which is so valuable for parents and families.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it definitely brings a unique insight for sure of not just like learning about like special education law and civil rights and ADA laws, but also, you know, understanding the impacts that compliance-based systems can have on neurodivergent learners' mental health.
Yeah. So we hear this phrase a lot recently, neuroaffirming IEPs, and I think sometimes the phrase is used correctly and sometimes the phrase is not used correctly. What does that mean to you, and what does it not mean to you?
Yeah, so neuroaffirming to me means, you know, recognizing intersectionality and honoring autonomy and agency and presuming competence. I mean, it's important that we recognize that, you know, we don't need to speak for disabled individuals. We need to listen and support them. And so that's what it means to me. What it doesn't mean to me is that a lot of times people will kind of use it as this, some people that, first of all, don't care for it will use it as a lens of like, oh, it means letting the learner do whatever they want, not take accountability for anything. Yes. And it's like, no, it's not what that means. on the other side, they'll also use it as in, you know, oh, I don't make goals for eye contact, right? But they'll subsequently make a goal where the learner is forced to engage socially for a certain amount of time. And yeah. So it's like, you're still missing the mark. And I think it's now become one of those buzzwords that a lot of people just use.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think too. And yeah, there's new eye contacts now. Like there's new, like sit and wait arbitrarily. I'm like, well, that's kind of the same thing as like, you know, similar root issue as eye contact. It's it's someone that doesn't get the core.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of IEPs that I think technically meet legal requirements, but families aren't happy with it. Maybe it doesn't feel supportive to students. Do you see that? And where do you see this disconnect happening between like, technically it's legally correct, but at the same time, are we giving the student everything that they deserve?
Yeah, so I see that often. And I really see that when it comes to, most schools will recognize, okay, we did this evaluation. And so we need to address all the things in the evaluation. One of the disconnects is often that we know that, especially for like insurance purposes and for school-based service purposes, a lot of the information comes through a deficit lens. And so because of that, they don't often see that by using a strength-based approach and looking at the strengths of the learner, we can actually remove more barriers that way. So I'll see a lot of IEPs that really focus on, you know, this learner is doing these not typical, not socially appropriate things, and we want them to do these typical and socially appropriate things, instead of this learner is having a hard time and needs support, and this is how we could remedy that.
Yeah. And like that shift in mindset can create very different goals and accommodations.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, like I use this example now ever since I was in an IEP meeting, and the speech therapist, we were talking about the importance of, you know, acknowledging that autistics have social skills. They just have different types of social skills and different views of social situations. And she noted where there was a goal for this high school autistic learner, and the goal was like, he had to ask two questions, and she was doing a social group, and he asked the question, the person answered it, and he felt like another question would be too private or personal and dive into too much. And so he just told her, he's like, I can ask another question. I'm not comfortable doing that because I feel like that would not be comfortable for them. And she said that was when she realized like, oh, it's, you know, again, it goes back to that presuming competence. It's not that he isn't capable of asking the question. It's that he feels like I wouldn't want someone to ask me a second question about that. And so I think like having that perception and understanding really would shape how you do goals and accommodations and how you approach the services that you provide.
If you're someone who supports learners with autism, whether you're a special ed teacher, an RBT, or a parent who wants the very best for your child, high quality applied behavior analysis training can make such a huge difference. If you've ever thought about deepening your expertise or advancing your ABA career, The Ohio State University has a program designed specifically for that. Ohio State offers a fully online Master's of Arts in Special Education with a specialization in Applied Behavior Analysis. And what's really cool is the program is fully ABAI accredited, which means all of the coursework and the degree meet the requirement to pursue your BCBA and get that credential. This is a field that is continuing to grow. In fact, the job postings have increased by 102% in just 2 years for BCBAs. So the demand for highly trained ABA professionals is definitely there. And I love the flexibility that this gives you. There are so many workplace options as a BCBA. Now, I got my master's in ABA when I was a classroom teacher, so I appreciate that Ohio State has this flexible program. It's fully online. It's designed for working professionals, which back when I got my degree, there were not that many out there. So if you're currently a teacher or an RBT, this is a great opportunity to advance your knowledge while keeping your full-time job. So if you've been thinking about it, now is the time to do the research and learn about this program. Check out Ohio State's online ABA master's program. You can visit go.osu.edu/autismhelper. I'm going to link that in the show notes. That's go.osu.edu/autismhelper. If you've been stuck on a 6-month wait list for a psychiatrist or bouncing between online mental health sites trying to find the right medication support, Talkiatry was built for you. It's a virtual psychiatric practice that actually fits your life and your insurance. Talkiatry is a 100% online psychiatric practice that provides comprehensive evaluations, diagnoses, and ongoing medication management. Unlike therapy-only sites, Talkiatry is psychiatry. That means that you'll be seeing a medical provider who can diagnose mental health conditions and prescribe medication when appropriate. All of their over 600 clinicians are in network with major insurers, so you can use your existing insurance instead of paying monthly out-of-pocket subscriptions or those out-of-network fees. Head to talkiatry.com/Sasha and complete the short assessment to get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes. That's talkiatry.com/Sasha to get matched in minutes. I love that example because that, you know, that teenager's very self-aware and very socially aware too, as opposed to just like arbitrarily drilling questions that do feel, then we get that like robotic, this isn't within social norms either.
Mm-hmm.
So a big trigger word for me is compliance, which I feel like maybe for you as well. And I feel like especially behavior plans are very compliance focused. Mm-hmm. And that can like bleed into the IEP within the social, emotional, and independent functioning goals. What are some common ways that this over focus on compliance within an IEP can unintentionally harm a student and in regards to their mental health as well? Because that's your area of expertise.
I think the biggest piece is, and I always say this when it comes to IEP meetings, is it can tell the neurodivergent learner, the autistic learner, to disregard their own cues, right? Mm-hmm. So if something makes me feel uncomfortable, something makes me upset, even if something, I'm excited about something, and you tell me like, that's not how I'm supposed to react or how I'm supposed to respond or what I'm supposed to say or what I'm supposed to do, you're missing the point of that. This is how I'm internally feeling this and connecting to this, if I'm connecting to it, right? Sometimes we know some autistics don't always connect to the emotion or have a name for the emotion, or recognize the feeling is tied to the emotion. And so you're telling them, disregard that because I want you to do this. Mm-hmm. And so what that does is, though, that forces them to question, one, whether they're feeling what they're feeling. It also forces them to, where we're already scanning and assessing a social situation, right? Because we recognize that we may be responding differently to our peers. It forces us to say, okay, how are my peers responding? And subsequently, how do I respond? And then it forces us to search for, often not pre-taught, but just told, strategies to implement. And that takes a toll on capacity. That takes a toll on your nervous system. It takes a toll on your window of tolerance and your ability to navigate stress. And so that subsequently is where we start getting learners that are just like, I can't make it to school today. I can't go to school today. Or like, I can only do half a day. Or like, I can't get out of bed, or I can't do the basic things like brush my teeth or take a bath because I'm exerting so much energy into doing the thing that you want me to do. And you're also disregarding what I may need in getting my perception.
Yeah, that's a really, really good way to put it. And gosh, how like hard would that feel to like not be able to trust your gut and to be able to question everything you're feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the biggest piece that I find when I mostly find myself rewriting social emotional goals for my learners, because I do sit at the IEP table for some of my families. I find myself always rewriting like the social emotional goals, and it's because there's just a disregard for what they're feeling and their perception. And it's like, imagine, and how I always frame it to adults is, imagine constantly being told like, you're wrong, what you're thinking is wrong, how you handled that is wrong.
I know.
Like, that's exhausting.
It's like exhausting to even think about.
Exactly. Like, I'm like just talking about it and thinking about it, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so drained.
Yeah.
And it's like, but we do that to autistic learners every single day.
And we're just really not building emotional regulation skills at all then. And we're actually like punishing any emotional regulation skills that they had.
Absolutely. And I'll see, when we go back to that compliance piece that you mentioned, I'll see where it's like they'll control their mood. They'll control their anger. I remember when my son was in kindergarten and he told me, he's like, Mommy, I'm trying so hard to not be angry. And I was like, first of all, you can be angry. And yeah. I don't know who told you that.
Exactly.
And I was like, and shame on them. And you know, I'm a whole mental health professional over here. So I was like, who told you that?
Let me find them.
Right. And of course we get in the building and then they're like, we don't know who told him that. I'm like, you all know who told him that.
Yeah.
But it's just like that's a lot of times the language I'll see too. It's just like when it comes out of that compliance lens. And I always go back to, you really just want the learner to be safe, and how better of a world it would be if we just said that. So instead of that, I'll see things like, we'll control anger, we'll not get upset. And I'm like, how are they supposed to control that? So I'm like, I'm like, why don't you just say, we'll use safe coping skills? And I'm like, but then you also subsequently have to teach them those coping skills. And that's the other layer that gets left, is that we just often teach compliance and we don't actually teach a skill that's actually usable later in life.
Yes. And I think similar to how you said, you know, this like concept of, you know, a neuroaffirming IEP or neuroframing goal is misunderstood. I think similar like this with compliance and with big emotions, hard emotions, emotional regulation, asking someone to not be angry, not be frustrated is not realistic. Instead, it's okay to be angry and jealous and worried and stressed. Those are all normal human emotions. And if we're not teaching what to do and how to sit with those hard emotions, we're just going to be like compressing them forever and never learn. And like you said, half day school, and now we can't do anything because we're struggling so much.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just that we don't ever teach, you know, often and rarely, I should say, you know, we rarely teach it's okay to feel those emotions. It's the way in which they're displayed that we have to talk about. Right. And that's what I have to often say when I go in the IEP meeting, because they're like, well, you're saying that. And I'm like, no, it's not okay that he kicked the teacher and the classmate. Like, it's absolutely not okay. But nobody in this room can tell me from his perception why he did it.
Yeah. I think people like jump to the next step. They're like, oh, what? I'm just going to allow him to rip up the class. No.
Exactly.
Just because you're angry doesn't mean you get to throw a desk, but you could still be angry.
Exactly. And that's the point that they forget. It's like you're telling them not to be something that you subsequently are.
Yeah.
Don't be upset, but you're upset at how they handled that situation.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Exactly. Oh, that's a really good point. Why do you think this conversation about mental health and honestly even emotional regulation is often left out of the IEP when it's often very clearly impacting learning?
Because of the compliance framework, because schools are very, you come here, you do the thing we tell you to do, and you go home. And that ignores many factors, which is that one, you can't control a person.
Mm-hmm.
Two, each person is individual. They have their own thoughts, feelings. They come with their own backgrounds, emotions, stories, actions. Some way in which you might see someone handle a situation, maybe how they were taught to handle the situation from what they've seen in the home. The other side of that, though, is just that children are people, and we don't see children as people. And so it's that very old school mindset of just like, you do what you're told when you're told to do it, and you're not allowed to have any feelings about it. And so that just translates over into that setting. And so a lot of times, even though they'll identify like they'll be able to even say like they're dysregulated, like they don't have coping skills. Like I will hear that so many times, and then they will turn around and the goal will not be based on developing coping skills. Due to the dysregulation, it won't be based on recognizing triggers. It won't be based on having the skills modeled and taught to them. It won't be based on helping them collaboratively problem solve. It'll be, they're doing this and they need to stop it.
Mm-hmm. And that's not how learning works. just read.
Right. Like, it's like, okay, all right. And I think what you just said is like a great way to frame that for people is that, you know, like, okay, I'm going to teach you to read now. Here's a paper.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Addition, do it. Like, come on.
Yeah, like, I don't, what?
Do you think ever teachers feel uncomfortable or like nervous that it's not in their like umbrella or like role or area of expertise on discussing mental health, especially with families? I feel like everyone's kind of sometimes worried to stay in their lane, that they stay too much in their lane and then don't talk about other things that maybe they should be having conversations with parents and the rest of the team on.
Absolutely. And I think I will hear educators talk all the time. My mother and sister are educators, and my friends that are educators, and I always hear educators, and even on my like social media platforms and stuff, talking about how like I just don't get this training. I don't get training in supporting disabled individuals, neurodivergent individuals, learners with anxiety, all these things. The other side of it, though, is that often they recognize it's not in their wheelhouse, but the person that they go to whose wheelhouse it should be in is not doing their own professional development to support the others.
Yes, that's and a good point.
I say that as a mental health professional, so I can say it to other mental health professionals. And what people don't recognize, too, is that school counselors often get placed to support mental health when they actually don't have a mental health background. So in the United States, school counselors, now there's many dual programs. When I first got my degree many years ago, there wasn't a lot of dual programs. So if you wanted to become a licensed professional counselor or mental health professional and work in the schools, you had to take courses and meet requirements for both programs. Now I have a lot of peers that are school counselors that are also licensed mental health professionals because they were, when they went to do their program, that was an option. Like this, you take these classes and this will also set you up for that. You have to remember a lot of school counselors are not actually mental health professionals. They are school counseling professionals.
Which is crazy because you're right. Teachers are then going to them being like, I need help with Johnny. And they're like, actually, I'm not sure what to do here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what they'll often say is like, so they'll often get taught how to teach coping skills, right? So they'll be able to say, oh, I can help with coping skills, but they're not actually trained in like mental health diagnoses. Mm-hmm. And how to connect that with subsequent coping skills. And they're definitely not trained on disabilities. So a lot of times what will then happen is they will then go to the school psychologist. And school psychologists are often trained in testing.
Yeah.
And so you see how there's this disconnect between what they're accessing. Now, again, I never want to generalize. There are a lot of individuals. So, for example, I'm a licensed professional counselor, but all of my degrees are in psychology. Mm-hmm. And so I actually had to learn how to do testing, even though I don't do testing as a mental health professional. And so it's that thing where it's like you never know really their background and the pieces to it, but I often more than not come in with that. Same with social work. When you get your bachelor's in social work, you're trained to be a case manager. You manage cases. You are not trained in mental health. It's not until you become a licensed clinical social worker and a licensed master social worker that you're actually trained in mental health. And so because people don't know that, they come to these individuals and these individuals don't often have the ability to say or feel comfortable saying, that's not my wheelhouse, because technically that's supposed to be my wheelhouse by the state of education, but by training, it's actually not.
You know, honestly, it's similar to me. It sounds like in hearing this, this is super interesting. As the degree for a special ed teacher, like as my licensure as a special ed teacher, I could teach preschool, self-contained, all high need students, all the way through high school resource room, students with a learning disability, pre-Cal, which I have no business being in that class. But that, I mean, it's so wide of a span. Like, how could you possibly teach a child who's medically fragile and then teach a high schooler with a learning disability under one licensure and one degree? And that's, it's so broad. And there's so many areas that you have to, like, seek out your own training or next certifications for to be specialized and really meet the needs of your kids.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And being in a, you know, social and community service field, like mental health is and education is, you're really seeking that out at your own dime.
Yeah. No one's paying for that. And like, also what I was thinking, not to throw another detour in here, but also throw trauma on top of this. I have mm-hmm. been in like the last 5-10 years, like, hungry for any training and workshop and literature I can get my hands on in regards to trauma, because I felt so wildly unprepared for working with any child that has a history of trauma. And most of my clients probably had. And I was like, I no longer even need to know if it is or isn't. I just want to make sure all of my practices are trauma informed. Mm-hmm. And as a teacher, as a BCBA, that's just not talked about. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about it with school communities as a whole, with teachers, paraprofessionals, assistants, bus aides, all these people that spend a lot of time with kids. And that's a whole other just like black hole where we're just not acknowledging it.
I have been getting Factor meals delivered for probably a few years now. And when I first discovered these, they were really a game changer. They are fresh meals that get delivered right to my house, pop them in the microwave, and 2 minutes later, I have a healthy, protein-packed lunch all ready to go. I'm like, where were these when I was in the classroom? I like how there's so many different options so I never get bored and that I'm eating healthy without having to do a whole ton of cooking. If you are looking to eat healthier, to do takeout less, or to just have something taken off of your plate mentally, having your lunches or dinners set up ready to go, I highly suggest checking out Factor. It's what I have tried, and I really think you would love it too. Head over to factormeals.com/Sasha50off and use code Sasha50off to get 50% off your first Factor box. If you're ready to try this, this is such a great deal. Get 50% off your first Factor box plus free breakfast for a year. Love that. Make healthy easier with Factor.
Absolutely. And I actually like just created a post that I'm going to put out that's about trauma. And that's, it gets into that, is that like, there's a difference between actually being, you know, being trauma informed and, you know, actually implementing trauma informed practices. But also, in order to truly be trauma informed, you have to be trauma informed about the population that you're supporting. And mm-hmm. most educators and school staff are not trauma informed on how to support neurodivergent or Black and Brown and marginalized learners.
Yeah. And then for maybe using strategies that are exacerbating the trauma they have.
Absolutely. Because they're compliance based, and trauma is not compliance based.
Exactly. So besides anything related to compliance, like when I see a behavior goal that says learner will be compliant, it's like, ugh, what other specific language on an IEP raises red flags for you?
I always say, like, I always start with my least favorite that I still have seen in 2026 is that learner will make eye contact. whenever I see the learner will comply with adult directives at all times, I've seen whenever I see that the learner will, you know, say yes and follow directions. I've had where my own son's IEP initially, they had it where he would not say no. And I was like, I'm sorry, excuse me. And I was like, what is the point of this? And so they were saying like they got ready to transition and he was not ready to transition. And so he had said no. And I said, so he struggles with transitions. And they were like, yes, but there was like a fire alarm or something. And they were like, so we needed him to transition. And then I was like, so you need him to transition at certain times due to safety. I was like, that's not the same thing as teaching him he can't say no.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing here? And so, and I always tell them, when you do that, and I come from that compliance mindset, you are setting up the learner to be victimized later on, because a lot of autistic learners are very black and white. And so we put that in the category of like, you know, so I'll see something like won't say no to adults, will comply with all adult requests. I'm like, no, absolutely yeah. not. Because everyone does not have the learner's best interest at heart. You don't have to like that. You don't have to yeah. want to think about it. But as somebody who's autistic and ADHD and a trauma therapist for children, I know that that happens more often than people would like to talk about.
Yes. And thinking about that IEP, even if you're envisioning that goal differently, that IEP is now a legal document. What if that child moves in 3 months and they go to a different school with a different teacher that's like, oh, this is what I got to do. Like, that's not how we're going to phrase it. You know, so you talked about goals related to following directions and kind of that cooperation / compliance, whatever you want to call it, piece. So a teacher listening that's like, okay, but we do need to work on, you know, being cooperative in the class, following directions. How can we get to the root of what that core skill is and create a goal that isn't compliance-based but does look at, like, yes, within the structure of the day, we do have to, you know, follow directions from the teacher and things like that.
Right. So I always go back to, when aren't they following directions? Mm-hmm. I've rarely found that it's all the time.
Yeah.
A lot of times it'll be time to transition. It'll be times where they're not prompted or prepped. It'll be times where they're doing something that they enjoy. It'll be times where they didn't get to finish a task. And so then I go back to, like, they'll say, okay, whenever it's time to transition from, if they're younger, free play to back to the academic activity. And I'm like, okay, so are they getting prepped? Is there a timer? Are you letting them know ahead of time? If they're not finishing, are you letting them know that they can finish it later? Are you giving them a designated time to do that? A lot of times it's more about that accommodation piece. Mm-hmm. Now, it's other times it'll be that they are not finishing because they need it chunking, which goes back to accommodations too. So I always just go back to, what's the underlying skill? And a lot of times it's like, if it's because they're not transitioning, which is what I find is usually when they say they need to follow adult directions and directives, what they're really wanting is they're wanting the learner to transition from one activity to another. And I'm like, you can actually make a goal that just says the learner will transition, and you can identify the ways in which you're going to help them do that. Visuals, prompts, cues, timing. I'm like, that can be the goal. And I was like, subsequently, while acknowledging that we need to identify what it is. And so sometimes I'll find where they're like, oh, they transition fine and outside of the classroom, like going to the next thing, but they don't transition from activity to activity. I'm like, oh, so we need to go on transitioning from activity to activity. And our data collection needs to look at what activities they're transitioning from and what they're not, and what needs to be used to help them transition.
Yes. And you know what? I actually think a more specific goal like that is a lot easier to work on and take data on, instead of this very vague, like, we'll follow directions. Like, I don't know, that could be happening in a multitude of ways throughout the day, but something more specific, will transition between centers within the classroom with these supports. Now I'm like, okay, I've got a plan. I know what I got to work on. I know what strategies I need to teach and what data I need to take.
Mm-hmm.
So what things can teachers do for families to make an IEP feel safer, feel more collaborative? We know this collaboration piece can be a little tricky. Are there any things that you've seen that educators have done that can kind of help create that bridge and setting that is more comfortable?
Yeah, I think first, every IEP has a parent input section where you have to get the parents' input. That's legally required per IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And I think when I see educators that actually use that section, they don't just take it as like, this is a box I have to check. Hey, mom and dad, like, what's your concerns? There's two sentences in there. But when they actually are like, are you concerned about anything academically, socially, emotionally, like getting to the root of that. For my parents, I have them do a parent input statement that looks at their learners, you know, when are they regulated? When are they not regulated? What are your concerns as they get older? What are their concerns? And I have them put that in the IEP, because that can help really look at where accommodations and supports are needed. So to facilitate that collaboration, one of the biggest pieces is opening up the communication. I have parents that don't know who their child's case manager is. I have parents who the case manager and them only talk once a year when it's time for the annual and it's time to get the meeting set up. Like, yeah, that does not facilitate a relationship, communication, or collaboration.
Yeah, that ongoing stream and not just knowing the teacher, right? Knowing the clinicians, knowing the case manager is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Can you share where people can go to learn more from you, Dr. Huff?
Yes, you can find me on www.destinyhuffconsulting.com. I'm on Facebook under Destiny Huff Consulting, and I'm more active on Instagram under Destiny Huff underscore IEP underscore advocate. And then I also have a podcast called the Affirming Village Podcast with my co-host and friend Lisa Baskin-Wright, where we bring our two perspectives to advocacy work. She's a former educator. And she's ADHD and dyslexic, and she has grown adult children, and one of her adult learners is odd HDer, and I subsequently am autistic and ADHD, and my two children are still very much in the public school system, still in elementary school, and then I have the mental health professional background. So that's the piece that we bring together to talk about how to be more affirming in the special education space.
Awesome. I will link all of those in the show notes so everyone can find you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Having the right resources for your classroom is essential to making sure your classroom is running smoothly. At the Autism Helper Shop, we have all of the resources you need to make sure you have the behavior, communication, and curriculum supports for your students. Within our shop, we have adapted books, task cards, resources aligned to the VBMAP and the ABLES, behavior plan flowcharts, data sheets, curriculum, everything you need, whether you are an early childhood teacher or a high school teacher, we have all of the resources that will meet those students' needs. So head over to shop.theautismhelper.com to check out all of our resources.